is Deborah Schwarzkopf's website. And again, this event tonight at the National College of Natural Medicine, 6:45. Deborah Schwarzkopf will be there, and you can ask her, share your stories. And that's about it for today. Thank you all for listening. This is KBOO. Thank you, Deborah, and thank you, Marcia.
Thank you.
All right. Stay tuned for more great programming.
Goes nothing.
Tune in to KBOO for Drinking from Puddles, hosted by Brandon, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. Don't say what you mean. That's Drinking for Puddles every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Yeah. RT, a news service formerly called Russia Today, is barely 10 years old, but it's making waves. Hillary Clinton said the United States is losing the information war to outlets like RT. John Kerry called it a propaganda bullhorn, yet RT is one of the most watched TV news sites in the West. Hi, this is Per Fogren. Friday at 11, I'll be talking with RT's news anchor, Anissa Nawe, and we'll be taking your calls. RT is on the web. Check it out and tune in Friday, May 22nd at 11 a.m. on KBOO, your radio station.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is just 1 minute after 9 o'clock. Coming up on KBOO next is Political Perspectives. We speak with Per Epson Stokeness about his new book, What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming, Toward a New Psychology of Climate Action. And later in the hour, we'll hear an interview with alternative energy expert Robert Staten, who says we can power the world with solar energy. At 10 on Air Cascadia, host Chris André speaks with Ted Gleichman of the Sierra Club about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. At 10:15, Flashpoints looks at how Mexican farm workers are fighting for their rights in Baja California, and Ajahn Pu, director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, talks about preparing for the elder boom in a changing America. And at 11, the food show features an interview with chef Nora Puyon, whose restaurant Nora was the first restaurant in the United States to be certified organic. Ajamu Umi, organizer for the All Africa People's Revolutionary Party, talks about starting a free breakfast program in North Portland. And Jim Myers talks about seed breeding research at Oregon State University. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent membership drive. If you missed it, it's not too late. You can still be part of it by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And now, Political Perspectives.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for the Radio Zine on KBOO. I'm speaking with Per Espen Stokeness. He is a psychologist and economist. He has founded clean energy companies. He now leads the Norwegian Business School's executive program on green growth. His new book is What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming. This book advocates for a new way to talk about global warming, a way that creates action and solutions, not further inaction and despair. Per Espen Stokeness, thanks for speaking with me today on KBOO.
Great being with you, Kathleen. Looking forward to it.
What prompted you to look at the psychology of climate action?
The question that really drives me is whether humans are inevitably short-term in their actions, or put more constructively, what are the conditions under which humans will act for the long term? And the reason is that more and more of my climate-involved scientist-based friends were recognizing that we were hopelessly stuck on a destructive path. And after having tried to convince people in general and the voting public that climate is important, the concern is actually declining. And, you know, very frustrated that people just don't get it. And people are so short-term and self-interested and all these things. And I really wanted to explore the psychology of that, because I had been working a lot as a consultant for energy companies and government in terms of energy policy and climate policy. But it always came back to the issue that it doesn't seem to the politicians that there actually is support from voters to actually prioritize climate when they vote, which means that people are short-sighted in terms, at least that's how it's interpreted. But are they really? Are we really so short-termism that we all drive the planet off the cliff? That's the question.
And one thing you said there that I wanted to kind of bring out a little bit is you said that even though the facts and the alarm over the issue of climate change have increased and have become more explicit and there's been more research, even though that's the situation, the concern among the public, you say, has actually decreased. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Declined, yeah. Yeah, the book really starts with that, the mystery of what I call the psychological climate paradox. And when you really trace back into the surveys, a very disturbing pattern emerges. I found good surveys both for the US and for Norway that got all the way back to 1989, asking the same question to a representative sample of people every second year since 1989. That's the last 25 years. And the surprising finding is that, on average, people were more concerned about climate change in 1989 than they are today. So it seems that the more scientific facts we have, the less concern, because we've been bombarding the public with, you know, 5 IPCC reports and 30,000 articles and scientific articles and many more news articles about this issue. And it seems more pressing than ever, yet the effect on the public is the opposite of what scientists intended. And that's a paradox.
You say that trying to convince people, individuals or groups, through facts does not work. So how do people respond to facts? Why does that not work?
Yeah. So my position now is that understanding how people respond to climate science is actually probably more important than understanding the climate system itself. We've had lots of progress on understanding the climate system, but very little progress on understanding people's responses. What I really did in this book is that I went through all the, let's say, 300 or 400 articles published on this issue from psychology, sociology, social anthropology, and then tried to condense the main findings into some simple concepts and models that everybody could use, actually. So doing this, I identified the 5 main barriers that keep people from taking in the seriousness of the climate issue. And they crop up quite regularly, and we have pretty good evidence-based ground to say that these are highly active, and when taken together, they actually explain this psychological climate paradox.
And I believe the first one of these barriers is the issue of self-interest. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Not quite. But since the self-interest issue can be aligned with also long-term issues, such as we do when people make a pension plan, when they plan like 40 years ahead. So it's not by itself. The barriers that I came up with are more in terms of how people perceive and respond to the climate science. And the first main barrier is actually distance, in the sense that people perceive the climate issue as being distant in time and scientists have been helping them with that, so to speak, because they talk a lot about the year 2100, by the which time most of us will be dead, so it's very distant in time, and then it's distant in space, so it typically happens with glaciers and Arctic ice and Bangladesh or the Pacific Islands, and that's always very far away from me, so there's a huge distance in geography. And thirdly, the impacts of climate typically, according to news, happens to other people, like poor people in suffering from the floods in Bangladesh or the cyclones in the Philippines or cities that are hit. But it's always somewhere else, somebody else. And finally, there's also distance and responsibility. Since we hear about these climate negotiations, the global climate negotiations, and these are, as I would say, may very prominent politicians and diplomats, and they're standing there on the stage, but I don't know them. I don't know anybody that does know them, and it's way outside my scope of influence, as the psychologist would say. So altogether, these four dimensions of distance make the issue less urgent to us, and it also reduces the issue importance. So it seems kind of hard to communicate climate, at least in a conventional way, and make people feel that is near and personal and urgent. And the first barrier creates that effect inadvertently.
The first one is distance, and that does fit in with your theory of sort of almost five Ds.
Yeah.
And so the second one is doom. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Since the early 1990s, the climate message has been framed this way. And this has to do with what psychologists call framing, which is not necessarily what you say, but what lies around what you say, the metaphor or the image, so to speak, that leads your thoughts in a certain way. And that image has been that they're saying that if we continue to emit CO2 like we do today, then the planet will burn and we'll all end up in hell, so to speak, or a catastrophe. And that's dooms framing that eventually makes people want to turn away from the issue rather than engaging with it, because many people feel there's not much I can do anyway, and after hearing these threats about, you know, mass migrations and cities that are underwater and population crash maybe and polar bears drowning and Arctic ice going away, and there's nothing I can do about it anyway, and the best thing is maybe to just withdraw my attention from it. So I think we suffer from after overuse of the doom and gloom story, we now have apocalypse fatigue. We are not motivated by it. Actually, the opposite happens. We avoid it, and fear and guilt is well known as emotions to make people pacified and not want to engage.
And so that leads into the third one, which is dissonance.
Yeah, exactly. Because if you look at our daily behaviors, we have all a set of habits going back to the 20th century. Last century, oil and gas and coal were cheap and abundant, and we didn't think much about it, so we built our lifestyles on it. So I drive, I eat a lot of meat, I fly, my house is maybe not very energy efficient. So when I look at how I actually live, then these behaviors conflict with my new knowledge. And this is what psychologists call the dissonance. It's a kind of nasty or uncomfortable feeling that I'm somewhat of a hypocrite, that I say one thing but I live the other way, and this creates a kind of questioning or a nagging doubt about myself, how good am I really. But then psychology research into dissonance have also showed that we're very good at finding ways to explain this away. So we like to, you know, we can modify one or two of these thoughts. I can say, for instance, well, actually, my emissions are quite insignificant. You know, it's the Chinese, or it's they, or it's my neighbor. He actually has a bigger SUV than I have. And that makes me feel a little bit better, because now it's somebody else is worse. And then I can also get rid of this dissonance by pointing out that the evidence is quite weak that CO2 causes warming. Actually, I've heard a scientist say, but it's the sunspots, really, or that climate has always changed, or it hasn't been much hotter since 1998, or these kind of things. So this kind of creates the demand side for disbelieving climate science. we've had a lot of supply of misinformation campaign. You know, like what I just said, that climate change is a hoax, or climate change is always happening, or it has been warming in the last 17 years. And these are, you know, from people with very little brain power and very little facts to back them up compared to what the climate scientists have. Yet, somehow people want to believe it, it seems, with a declining concern. And I think dissonance explains quite a bit of that, because if I can then disbelieve the climate science, then I'm off the hook. Then the dissonance, so to speak, disappears. So you can actually expect a backlash on such a serious message, as the climate science is saying, as long as there are no opportunities, or very few opportunities, to behave in a consistent way with it.
Okay.
So to me, the dissonance explains why, after having heard about it for 25 years, but we still can't do much about it, that's the feeling I have, then I prefer to distance myself from the topic and give it lower priority and not think much about it.
Is that what's called denial? And denial is your next barrier. Exactly.
Because the dissonance, if it persists, it might eventually lead to denial. And denial is a very well-known psychological mechanism that people have to how to separate yourself from knowledge that is troubling or very uncomfortable. And what denial is actually is that rather than just a dissonance, you're entering a state where you're living a double life. And that means that on the one hand, I know what's happening. And if I go into that room, so to speak, that inner room in myself, then I know it's very troubling. But then having erected some barriers around that room or locked the door, so to speak, I can go on my life as if I don't know it. So you could call that a resistance to taking it in, or really maybe a repression of what we actually know. So we don't want to go thinking about that all the time, and then we automatically shut it down. And I'd like to take a little time to dwell on the word denial, because that's been used a lot as a pejorative on the other side. They are deniers. You shouldn't deny. You should, you know, see the truth or whatever. But we should also acknowledge that it is hard to take in that, for instance, if you look at your child or a young child today, he or she might end up living in a world that's warmer and has a very different landscape and climate than in the previous 800,000 to maybe 3 million years or more. And really taking that in creates a resistance in us. So to a certain extent, I would say most of us have this capacity of denial inside of us. And we maybe need a little bit of it to kind of get along in our daily lives. So that's the barrier. I don't want to use denial as a pejorative of the other side, as a synonym for as if they're stupid or ignorant or unintelligent or just plain immoral, because it is a deeply deep human pattern, really.
And the last of these barriers that you write about is, it's a D, but the D is the second letter in the word, identity.
Exactly.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. I had to cheat a little bit, as you're so, to get them really the distance, the doom, the dissonance, the denial, and the identity. So what is that? Well, psychology knows that, let's say these scientists, they were doing their job in the lab coats and the models and then coming out and saying to the world, well, listen, guys, you're all living in the wrong way. And if that message is perceived as threatening my self values, those values that guide my life, my lifestyle, then we know from psychology there's a want to kind of shoot back at the messenger who's accusing me. He or she somehow thinks she's holier than me, or, you know, the holier than thou situation. And then I would prefer to listen to an expert maybe that holds the same values or the same worldview as me, and I will look around to see if maybe there's another expert around that is more in line with my identity, my professional identity, my ideological identity, my political identity. And that's not too difficult to find. And what this shows, the research on the psychological research on this, is that we tend to process the facts so that they would match my values, my identity, my pre-existing belief, rather than having my values changed because of new facts. So you'd say that identity easily overrides new knowledge. And this has been well explored, for instance, if you give a number of people the question of, is the Earth getting warmer? A, mostly because of human activity, such as burning fossil fuels, or B, mostly because of natural patterns in the Earth's environment, well, then A is the right answer from a science point of view. And the more science intelligence or the more education people have, in average, they would get that more correct. However, if you split all subjects in the experiment into according to their values, let's say liberal versus conservative, then you get the situation that liberals very quickly get that answer more correct the more education they have. But the other way goes that if you have a conservative and you somehow find that science, climate science, is hitting against your belief in free market and free choice and avoiding a big government, then you would tend to reinterpret the facts or avoid them so they fit with your values. And that's what we actually see. The more education and the more intelligence you have as a conservative, the more you get it wrong.
I'm speaking with Per Espen Stoknes, or Stoknes. He is a psychologist and an economist. We are talking about his new book, What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming. It looks at the new psychology of climate action. I'm Kathleen Stevenson. So we've talked about these principles, these barriers that are keeping the issue of climate change. And I should say that you prefer, what term do you prefer when talking about this? What is your preferred term?
Well, these barriers are upkeeping the psychological climate paradox.
Mm-hmm.
That is that the more science we get, the less people seem to engage.
And I was thinking of, what term do you prefer? There's been a controversy about climate change, global warming.
Oh,
and I know you
yeah, I missed that point.
That's okay.
Thanks. You know, there's been studies on these concepts and to see what kind of associations and emotions they evoke. And among them, the climate change seems to be the most, so to say, neutral and scientific. However, it easily lends itself to the question, well, climate has always changed, and that's a way to explain it away. Global warming, however, is more provocative and more emotionally engaging among most audiences. So that's why I picked the word global warming for the title. However, I see also weaknesses with the concept of global warming. For instance, that, like what happened in the east coast of the U.S. This winter, is that we tend to look at the weather when we evaluate the climate. And global warming doesn't mean that it's always going to be warmer weather. So my preferred term is actually neither of the two, but I would often use the word climate disruption. Because that's what it's really about. Our civilization has developed in a very stable climate over the last few thousand years. And what we're seeing is rapid disruptions in the weather that will make it much harder for civilization to continue its kind of stable operations.
I believe you say there are three principles to build on: turning the barriers upside down, sticking to positive strategies, and acting as social citizens, not individuals. So can you talk about that, about how you see these barriers being dealt with by someone who wants to, I think, basically convince others of the impact of climate disruption?
Yeah. If you're involved in some climate communication effort, I've suggested that we flip these barriers over into success criteria, and that's where we start. So in order to get climate across to the new audiences, we need to make it feel personal, near, and urgent. And we also need to use framings that do not backfire on the climate issue through their negative feelings, such as the doom and the catastrophe framing does. And we need to provide opportunities for more visible and consistent action, so we reduce the dissonance barrier. We need to avoid triggering the emotional need for a denial, which exists in all of us. And finally, we need to reduce the political polarization on this issue. And this can be done by five new solutions that I write about in the book. These are not really new in any way, but the way they're emerging is that they are quite distinct from the conventional climate communication, which was to say we should cut the emissions, otherwise we're going to experience a much warmer world. It's going to be a catastrophe. Rather than just presenting the facts and more reports on the issue, we need to make this message more social. And we can do that through social norms, social media, and social networks. Maybe the simplest example is rooftop solar, which is now shown to be contagious, so to speak. If you have a neighborhood and then one house puts on panels on their roof, then suddenly the likelihood of the other houses in that neighborhood will go way up for them also getting solar panels. What this shows is the deep psychological insight of what we do doesn't really depend on what kind of egghead scientists say, but it depends on what others do, and particularly those that we aspire to be like. And that's why I think we have to embed this, the climate science message, in social networks of neighborhoods, cities, communities. And one example is, for instance, Bergen in Norway, where they are being inspired by the transition town movement to turn around the gloom into party, collaboration, fun and cool. So their motto is really from protest to party, or which is better in Norwegian maybe, fra protest til fest. And this builds on sound social science. Let's say there's a study done by Professor Bob Cialdini, which has to do with using peer pressure as a tool to make people take more long-term choices. And he set up a study where there were four groups of households. The first group of households were told that they should conserve energy for the sake of sustainability and because the Earth needs it, or the planet. The second group were told that, well, you should reduce your energy consumption for the sake of your children and your children's children. So, in other words, for future generations' sake. Third group were told they should cut power use because it's profitable. It cuts your energy bill. And the fourth group were simply told how much they used compared to their neighbors. And when comparing these four groups, what came out clearly as the most effective was not sustainability, not future generations, not profitability, but what your neighbors do. And the reason this works is that it makes the climate feel much nearer and much more relevant. It's no longer about the year 2100 or so and so many inches of sea level rise per decade, which are numbers we can't relate to anyway. But this is about what people I know are actually doing and how I am comparing to those. So the same principle that has now been commercialized by the company O-Power, and they've saved terawatt hours of energy. And also now in California, with the huge success of O-Power, it's a new company called WaterSmart, who's now trying to use the same principles to improve the water use of people. A third example I'd like to mention of this strategy, or this solution, which is to use the power of social networks, is the Green Sports Alliance. And Green Sports Alliance uses the fact that people really look up to sports heroes, sports teams. And if you can green the events they have or green the behavior of leading sports heroes, then this easily spreads through the power of social norms and social networks to a much larger audience. So this is all based on evolutionary psychology, because we really like to compare ourselves, to imitate with others, and to achieve status through some kind of dimension. And this is about turning the competition into a more constructive dimension. That was briefly on the social network side. The next major strategy, it has to do with how we avoid the doom barrier. And that is by using frames that are much more supportive. Psychological research shows that if you're framing the climate issue as a health topic, then people are feel it much more relevant and personal and urgent. So by pointing out that when there is more CO2, that you get much more pollen, let's say just some percentages of increase of CO2 will give you maybe a double or half as much pollen in some areas, and pollen allergies will surge, also along with asthma and heat-related stresses and heat-related violence. all these things will rise, and therefore climate is really a health issue. It has to do with what's killing me today, with underline of killing me and today, so that it's felt as much more near and relevant to do something about it. There are two more frames that I'd like to mention, and the second one is that has to do with risk and insurance rather than catastrophe, because we have ways of dealing with that. Most of us have fire insurance for our houses, but do we believe that the house would burn down? No, but we still pay the fire insurance because, you know, it might happen. And the same way we could frame the climate issue, we should pay a little bit today in order to avoid the risk of the planet burning down and removing our stable weather patterns where I live. So this concept of insurance and risk is much better than uncertainty and catastrophe. And thirdly, the third supportive frame has to do with the endless opportunities for more better societies, better technology, better business that the climate and the energy transition implies. I like the example of solar roadways, which was a new startup last year that got millions of dollars from people's gifts because they wanted to crowdsource and support the opportunities of having smart roads that could, you know, show information on the road and have some intelligence to it and also generate much more energy than it needs to operate and also power the cars that run on it. So why, if we have smart buildings, smart phones, why couldn't we have smart roads? And this is the type of imaginative opportunity that we really need to get a positive longing or a positive enthusiasm to doing something about it.
What I'm going to ask might fall into one of the categories of barriers. I'm thinking about the issue of water shortages in California right now.
Yeah.
And so people are being asked by the governor to restrain their use of water, and you could maybe apply some of these principles to that ask. But at the same time, a critic might say the individuals can make all these changes, and yet the corporate agriculture that's in that area, if they don't change, then the individual changes are not going to make any difference. And I wondered how you respond to that, how you make sense of that in what you're talking about.
Yeah, thanks, Kathleen. I think that's an excellent and very important point. Some people, as you say, make a criticism out of climate psychology because they say, well, you're individualizing the solutions, saying that if only neighborhoods cut their power or water consumption one by one, then we'll solve it. And that's not what climate psychology is saying. Climate psychology says that we have these barriers that hold us back from supporting the structural solutions. So you're spot on when it comes to saying these nudges, these social networks, and these framings doesn't really solve the climate issue as such. However, they remove the barriers we have to really engaging. And the solution to both the water problem and the climate problem are structural. As you say, it has to do with agribusiness, with energy systems, with transport systems. And therefore, we need to really push the politicians and the companies to really do something different. And the only way we're going to make that happen if we can build a sufficient bottom-up support from the public. So the politicians have no choice but actually implementing it or be ousted. So this is the real purpose, not to solve the climate problem, but to solve the climate paradox that I was mentioning, that why we don't really stand up and demand change. This whole psychology of climate that I'm talking about is actually designed to increase the bottom-up pressure for forcing change, structural change, through our society.
Maybe in light of that, you might also address the issue of hopelessness, because I think sometimes when we think about the how overwhelming the structural parts of this are, that we get stuck in hopelessness, and I wonder...
Yeah, we do. And it is depressive. And since this is an edited version, you can take it off if you want, but, you know, we are f***ed. We're really f***ed. I mean, we're in a very difficult position, and it's very hard to see any good solution to it. And as a psychologist, I really try to have people dwell with that and allow that feeling of despair and hopelessness and depression and blackness just, you know, arise and letting it take its time to kind of flow through you. Because it's the kind of grief that we haven't really properly mourned about, that we're, this knowledge that we're actually destroying so much of the forest and so much of the water aquifers and so much of the oceans. And it really needs to be acknowledged in a deep way in ourselves. And the good news is that if we do allow ourselves to kind of let that blackness, that despair flow through us, what seems to happen is that this distancing and this numbing and this denial that's been keeping us from engaging cracks open, and we start to care again on a much deeper level. So rather than just jumping into all positive and Pollyanna hope and just go do it, I recommend people really giving time to digest or dwell with that feeling of hopelessness, because it is very valid. And the paradox in that, which I call the despair paradox, is that the more of that despair we're actually allowing ourselves to feel and maybe share and go through together, the more we recognize the beauty and the amazing life we have all around us, and what the air is actually doing for us every day, every breath, and the colors of the sky, etc. If we don't allow ourselves to mourn and feel depressed, then we're numbed and we're shutting it off. And the opposite way, if we really let that change us, then suddenly a much deeper caring may come through. Mm-hmm. And that's what I talk about a lot in the third part of the book, where I move from what we can call doing to being.
And you talk about maybe climate disruption is a symptom and it's trying to tell us something. What would that be?
Yeah, because the conventional way of looking at it is that the climate is something way out there that had nothing to do with me. It's the Arctic ice, it's the polar vortex or whatever, or it's the ocean currents that we can't do anything about anyway. But let's say now that the permafrost or the burps of methane are increasingly coming up from the tundra up north. That is the direct consequence of our burning of fossil fuels. So we cannot say anymore that the natural reactions way out there are separate from us. What we're seeing actually is a human climate interaction that makes it very difficult to say what is a natural process and what is a human-made process. And the message here is really that we are intimately woven together with the air, with natural processes. And since we're having a big impact now, we don't really know where that impact ends. So this is the end of the polarization of the opposites of nature on the one hand and humans on the other. What's actually happening is now we're seeing that we're intimately interconnected with the natural processes. And I think that's a deeper message of the climate disruptions.
Do you have hope?
Ah, yes. Isn't that a good question? I mean, most people, particularly politicians, need to end up with being a positive and hopeful and beaming full of opportunities and positivism. And I think this hope is a very muddled word, and after having been overused, it's kind of hard to say, well, yes, I'm hopeful and smile, because at the same, that seems as if I'm denying the reality of the situation, which is pretty dire. Yet I think what at least gives meaning to me, since you asked me, Kathleen, is that I don't have hope that the solutions we are trying will have an immediate and positive outcome. So my hope is dependent upon winning, so to speak. Rather, what my hope is grounded somewhat more deeply in who I am and what I believe I stand for, and also my connection with the air. So whatever happens, I'll give it my all, and that has its own type of hope and joy to it. So the actions I do, the words I say, seem to draw nourishment from something larger than me, and that's a hopeful, grounded place to be in, even if I don't say with a hope that this will have a quick and only positive outcome and soon, which I tend to find difficult to believe. Mm-hmm. So there might be hope, yet no optimism. And this is something that I also look deeply into the last chapters of the book.
Yeah, I think I can relate that to just thinking of applying the change in thinking that you write about, in applying that to my own way of dealing with this issue, that it would seem that if you really thoughtfully applied those principles, that you would end up in a space of, and again, I don't know whether to call it hope, but you would have more peace, at least, perhaps.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Or some kind of inner joy that what you do has meaning, even if you cannot oversee the final outcome of the situation.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking about this with me. Again, the book we've been talking about is What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming. The author is Per Espen Stoknes. I'll spell his last name. It's Stokenes. And this is published by Chelsea Green Publishing. Per, thank you again very much for speaking with us today.
Oh, thanks for very good questions, Kathleen. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Same here. Thank you.
You are listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO Portland. Now we'll hear an interview from the series Radio EcoShock. Host Alex Smith speaks with alternative energy expert Robert Staten on powering the world with solar energy.
If we stopped using fossil fuels today, the climate would still heat up somewhat and civilization would crash. That's a nasty problem, and we need a roadmap out. Robert Staten says solar power is the path forward. He's been teaching about energy and solar power for decades at California Colleges and the University of California in Santa Cruz. Those years of expertise are drawn together in his new book, Power Shift, From Fossil Energy to Dynamic Solar Power. Robert